Well, it's been a mission of mine to bring these visionary plants to society and integrate them in a good way. And that's going to take many lifetimes of work, not just mine.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Suitcase. I'm Dave McNee. Some days it feels like psychedelics are about to go mainstream, the way cannabis was a few years ago. It seems that it's everywhere these days. But are we handling the transition the right way? Will it fall into the hands of big business, or will the people who need the medication have it available, or will it just be for those who can afford it? The use of psychedelics are a bit more nuanced than cannabis, but there are some similarities, and how they are sold to the public are starting to take shape. To find out more about the road we should go down and the pitfalls we should look out for, in this episode we talk with cannabis pioneer and activist Andrew D'Angelo, who has seen the cannabis industry grow right from its retail inception, from before it was legal, to the for-profit business it is today. Andrew and his brother Steve started Harborside in 2006. But it wasn't until 2018 when they sold the first legal gram of weed. It's also the year that they won Best Dispensary in California, which is no small feat. I was curious as to how Andrew got started in all this.
Well, my introduction to the cannabis world came through my older brother, Steve D'Angelo, which many of your listeners may be more familiar with than me. Steve is about 10 years older than me. So I was introduced to cannabis when I was a teenager by Steve. I immediately fell in love with the plant. Steve and I had difficult childhoods. Our parents split up. Our brother died. Right. So cannabis was a very good teacher and healer for us. We didn't necessarily seek out cannabis in the beginning when we were teenagers to heal ourselves, but that's exactly what ended up happening. And that healing, I think, made us pretty devoted to cannabis, and we fell in love with cannabis. And we grew up in a political family. My dad worked for the federal government. My parents answered the call when John Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And they served the country. And so I grew up with a family of public servants. And so this idea that cannabis was prohibited and illegal was absurd to me. And I had enough of a background in social activism to give a run at trying to devote my life to freeing the plant. It took a lot longer than we thought. when I first started at 18 years old, went off to college, I figured, 5-10 years, we'll have cannabis legal all around the world and I can move on to other things. Right. But it took a lot. It's taken a lot longer than that. And certainly your country, Canada, beat America to the punch in terms of federal legalization. And we're still struggling here to make that happen. But as you and your listeners may know, 33 states have legalized cannabis in some way, shape, or form in the United States. So we're well on our way. And, I also started Harborside, which is one of the first legal cannabis businesses on earth, the city of Oakland, where I live. And it was the first city to issue licenses for cannabis anywhere in the world when California was the only place in the world that had legal medical cannabis. So that was 14 years ago. And, Harborside's a big vertically integrated company, publicly traded on the CSX in Toronto.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've since exited Harborside. But that experience taught me an awful lot about what it's like to take a compound that's a psychedelic like cannabis, which is a tryptophan, and bring it into society and integrate it into society. And we got a lot of things right along that journey. We also got some things wrong. And I don't want to see the psychedelic community make those same mistakes.
So what mistakes are those? What pitfalls should we look out for?
Well, I think primarily the first thing that we have to do with respect to psychedelics is just acknowledge that they're very unique compounds, and that we have to respect these compounds and we have to understand them and figure out good strategies to integrate them into society. If people take these compounds in the wrong set and the wrong setting, very bad things can happen and a lot of harm can be done.
Right.
And so, and we've seen that with cannabis, with edibles, pets getting into edibles, children getting into edibles. That's why Harborside started putting edibles in childproof packaging. We were the first company ever to do that. That's why we did it, because we started to see that if people were not keeping these compounds locked up and safe in their house, that pets and kids can get into them. And so as a society, we have to learn from that, right? And and make sure that we protect the household from these compounds getting in the wrong hands. So that's one lesson. The other lesson is just, you know, how much profit and how much exuberance of capitalism should we use in the beginning, particularly with integrating cannabis into, not cannabis, but psychedelics into society.
Right.
It can really, the profit motive with these compounds is complicated. And I would say that a nonprofit model for manufacturing and distribution is probably the way to start. That's how we did it in California.
Right.
With medical cannabis, and it worked a lot better. So that's the second lesson. I think that you know, I'm already starting to see psilocybin startups wanting to trade on the public markets, and I think that's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
just a few, well, maybe months ago now. Didn't a company actually trademark psilocybin, the word psilocybin? I think there's an American.
I saw something along those lines. And again, this kind of bad behavior, you know, people are trying to trademark and patent cannabis right now. And, you know, and that whole class of the whole investor class of people, I love them. I care about them. They're important, right? Capital is important. We have to grow. And so I don't want to demonize that group of people, but I do want to illuminate that there's more to life than just chasing a profit and trademarking things and creating IP and exploiting that IP to make a lot of money when you're talking about psychedelic compounds, even cannabis, which is a tryptophan. So that's the issue, right? Is that we have to have a much more diverse approach than a winner take all model. And that's the problem with things like trademarking the word psilocybin or starting a publicly traded company for psilocybin when psilocybin isn't even legal yet. You know, we have to sequence the way in which we do these things properly. And you've got groups like MAPS. And MAPS has been working on this for decades. And Rick Doblin, the CEO and founder of MAPS, I don't know if he's CEO, president, and leader of MAPS, visionary of MAPS, he's figured it out. And we should listen to Rick and listen to MAPS. And they have spent many, 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 many years and thousands of hours studying how psychedelics can be integrated in a good way into society. They have worked very hard to rebrand psychedelics away from the negative stigma of the 1960s, that the media wasn't the counterculture that created that negative stigma. It was the media and the mainstream culture. But now, you know, MAPS and Rick and some other folks have rebranded. Michael Pollan is in there. Have rebranded psychedelics. And we have to build on that rebranding very carefully, very mindfully, and not rush into things too fast. What happens when you legalize a compound is that all kinds of people who were afraid of it before are not afraid of it anymore.
Right.
With respect to psychedelics, people do need to be afraid of the compounds themselves, or at least mindful of the compounds themselves, not just the laws that prohibit them. And people get confused, right? And so that's why Rick Doblin has developed an idea where people have to go get a learner's permit or a driver's permit before they can legally purchase psychedelics. That companies that sell psychedelics should probably, I don't know if he's got a nonprofit in there, but I think they probably should be in the beginning. Maybe the compounds themselves can be in for-profit models. I know MAPS has a project to create MDMA for therapeutic uses using a for-profit entity. And I could see that, you know, being very beneficial to allowing them to grow, very quickly once the walls come down. You know, those are the three big things that I think the cannabis lesson can teach everybody else. And the fourth one is we have to legalize it in the right way. Look what's happening in California and Canada with respect to cannabis in terms of two markets, one illicit, one legal. I call it legacy, not illicit. And now we have all this division and all this strife, and people are talking about launching Prohibition 2.0 against the legacy to protect the legal, which is crazy. And if we do that with psychedelics, remember, there's a certain segment of the population that uses psychedelics fairly regularly. Now, all that activity, all that supply chain is happening in an underground network right now. That underground network is decentralized. It's working fairly well. You're not seeing a lot of harm happening in society from this network, right? And what happens is when if you disrupt that network too much and you do not allow that legacy network to do the job they're already doing, you're going to have big problems with two different markets. It's going to cause terrible, terrible problems when you're talking about compounds that are a lot stronger than cannabis.
Andrew just mentioned an organization called MAPS. If you don't know about MAPS, I suggest you check them out. MAPS.org, I believe, is the website. They're a great organization that are leading the way in psychedelic research. I'm always curious about how psychedelics will be rolled out in the future. How would you do it? Would it be a dispensary model where people could just go buy it? Would it be a supervised center that you could go to? It got me wondering what Andrew's ultimate goal for psychedelics would be.
Well, I obviously, you know, the ultimate goal is that psychedelics are so well known and the whole population is so familiar with them and so well educated about them that, you know, we do things like have, you know, big psychedelic rituals and ceremonies together that are but we can't go from where we are today to that point overnight.
No.
And so the ideas of the clinics is a brilliant idea because it is a step that we can take towards that ultimate goal. And yes, I absolutely, you know, Harborside is a cannabis company, so I don't see Harborside, entity known as Harborside, doing that. But I do see companies, nonprofit organizations, I hope at first, that create these centers, and they will be community centers. And I think they can do more than one thing besides being a place where people can trip together or be guided on a trip. I think there's mental health services that can be provided. I think there's a whole host of creative endeavors that could be included that are, you know, whether it be art therapy for people or other kinds of integrations that we could do in these centers. I could see sound bath meditations happening in centers like this. I could see, you know, meditation and yoga being a part of centers like this. Mm-hmm. What we were able to do with Harborside when we were in the medical models, we were able to create a community center. It wasn't just a dispensary where we sold weed and people bought weed. It was a community center. So if you wanted to write a letter to a cannabis prisoner, you could come to Harborside and do that. If you wanted to get free medicine because you were poor, you could come to Harborside and do that. If you wanted to get a free yoga class or recce treatment because you were poor, you could come to Harborside and do that for free.
Yeah.
Because we took the profits that we were making on the weed and we reinvested it in those programs because we are mandated by law to operate as a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And so we did. We took that mandate very seriously. And yeah, there was profits generated, but we were able to take those profits instead of giving them to some investors, not to say that's bad. We love giving profits to our investors. Don't get me wrong. But instead of giving it to investors, we gave it to the community.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I definitely see community centers that do a lot more than just our psychedelic trip centers. Maybe that's what they are at first, because we have to, you know, we have to, as I said earlier, build this in steps and in stages. What's going to happen as people go to these centers and they have these great experiences and they become more well and they heal themselves more and more people are going to want to experience it. And then there's going to be a movement for this to be allowed in your own home and outside of the centers. And then we'll take the next step into integrating. And so once you do have your permit, your trip license, I guess you could call it, then you may be able to go to a center that is now a dispensary also, or maybe even just a dispensary,
right,
and get, you know, whatever the psychedelic is that you're permitted to buy. And I think you should have a separate permit for each compound. Rick Doblin even thinks that we should have a permit for alcohol consumption. So that when you behave badly under alcohol, if you beat somebody up or you get in a car wreck or you hurt somebody, that your alcohol thing gets taken away from you and you can't buy alcohol for a while until you go through some kind of treatment program or re-education program and get yourself straight. You know,
yeah.
I think it's not a bad idea society to look at psychoactive compounds with a little bit more responsible individual responsibility, I guess you could say.
Andrew's social activism has been present throughout his whole career. Something he started recently is the Last Prisoner Project. The idea behind it is to try to release every single person that's in jail right now for cannabis charges and rehabilitate them once they're out. It's hard to believe that there are people sitting in jail right now for something that is currently legal. Just this week alone, I was reading a story about Derek Harris, a military veteran who's serving a life sentence for selling less than $30 worth of marijuana. He was arrested in 2008 and just got out now.
Last Prisoner Project is a nonprofit organization my brother Steve and I and a few other people started about a year and a half ago.
Right.
And Steve and I, over my 37 years, my brother almost 50 years now of doing cannabis, being in the cannabis trade, meant that we had a lot of friends and family members get busted over the years. And in the old days when that happened, you had to rely on your community to bail people out and to hire legal defense so that the whole network didn't get busted and go down with whoever got busted. Because the way law enforcement in the United States works is they bust one person and they get them to rat on everybody else. And the way you prevent that from happening is you make sure that everybody knows that they're taken care of if they should get busted. And so we had to do a lot of that over the years. And then when we got legal and we opened Harborside, we had the program where you could write a letter to a prisoner to get free cannabis from Harborside. So we've always had this connection to our brothers and sisters that are in prison. And once Harborside went public and we were able to have a little bit of more bandwidth than we did for many years running the day-to-day of Harborside, you know, the first thing we wanted to do was pay attention to our prisoners. And so that's the idea for Last Prisoner Project. It was really my brother's vision for the organization itself. The genesis of it was really something that's been planted over many years and decades. And, you know, the mission of LPP is very simple. We want to get every cannabis prisoner who's in jail right now, not only in the United States, but everywhere in the world, out. And then once we get them out, we want to make sure their records are expunged so they're not carrying around a record that hurts them in the future. Right. And then, you know, once they're out and their records expunged, we want to help them get a job and train them and get an apartment back on their feet. We have, we're building an interesting training program that will allow prisoners who are out to enter the training program and then get hired by the legal cannabis industry so that they can, we're trying to build a prison to legal cannabis industry pipeline instead of a streets to prison pipeline.
Yeah.
We're trying to build one the other way around. So that's the work. That's all we do is cannabis prisoners. We don't do any other types of prisoners right now. We try to be very narrowly focused. There's a lot of groups working on mandatory minimums. There's lots of groups working on ending the drug war. There's lots of groups working on lots of different things. But we found that there wasn't anyone really whose singular focus was this. Mm. And we've since learned of a few other groups who are doing this, who started around the same time we have, or sometimes a little bit before, sometimes a little bit after. And we're all trying to coordinate and work together. And yeah, we have had some success stories. Let me just make sure I'm getting everybody's name right. We had Claude DeBoak was freed after 26 years. And then we had another guy, Craig. Let's see, I just got to look him up. Craig was just freed. And Craig just got out. I forget his last name, Sissal. Craig Sissal has been freed after 18 years of a life sentence. So now Craig is in home confinement. And that was, Craig's probably our biggest success story. You know, some of our constituents are people that are locked up for life. And those are the ones where they're some of our top priorities. And Craig was one of them. And we were able to free him. Michael Thompson's another guy we're trying to get out. Michael Thompson's locked up in Michigan. He's in his late 60s, African-American man. He's been in for 23 years. 3 pounds of weed this guy sold to an undercover cop. Harborside sells more than 3 pounds of weed in the first 2 hours we're open for business.
Right.
So you know, it's ridiculous. It's that outrageous. Right? And so if people go to lastprisonerproject.org, you can learn all about how to help people like Michael Thompson.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
And make... Yeah, you can make a phone call, you can write a letter, you can sign a petition. It's all very easy. Lastprisonproject.org/get involved. And we make it really easy, not just for individuals, but cannabis companies to get involved. So we have several programs for cannabis companies to get involved and help get prisoners out. And in exchange, we give you a little Last Prisoner Project logo that you can put on your products, or that you could put in your store and let your customers know that you're a supporter of Last Prisoner Project. And people have just responded to this idea and this initiative in tremendous ways. We were growing fast and people are jumping on board with significant donations, and we're able to build out our team a little bit. And it's a very exciting time for Last Prisoner Project. We have many, many years, if not decades, of work to get this done globally. Mm-hmm. But I think we're off to a good start, and we've built some nice momentum. And hopefully everybody out there in the cannabis and psychedelic community will help us get our brothers and sisters out. And as soon as psychedelics are legal, and perhaps even before that, I know there are groups working on getting our psychedelic prisoners out.
Right.
Because some of those folks are looking at very long sentences, especially in the United States. If you get busted with a large amount of LSD or something, a psilocybin in the United States, that's quite serious amount of time that you're doing.
So how do they go about actually getting these people out of jail? Who do they have to talk to? Whose decision is it?
So how does it actually work under the letter of the law is a good question. And it probably works different in different countries. So I can tell you how it works in the United States. In the United States, if you get busted for weed, you're either charged by the state that you got busted in, or you're charged by the feds, and sometimes you're charged by both. in the case of a state charge, if you're locked up for in a state penitentiary and you've been convicted and you've exhausted all your appeals in court, the only way to get out is for a governor of that state to sign a clemency petition.
Okay.
And the clemency petition is something that we work on with our constituents. We worked on Michael Thompson's clemency petition because it takes a long time to get that petition all the way through all the different layers of bureaucracy, parole boards, prosecutor offices, all these people have a hand in it. And then it finally, once the parole board votes to send it to the governor's desk, then the governor has to decide whether or not they're going to sign it.
Right.
Governors traditionally are very, very reluctant to sign it, basically because of they're worried that they won't get reelected if they issue clemency to somebody who gets freed and then they go out and commit a crime.
Yeah.
So they're very risk averse. There was a famous political ad called Willie Horton that George H. Bush did in 1988.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that's the one that still scares all the politicians, and they won't sign these petitions just because of Willie Horton and for no other reason.
Right.
And Willie Horton was, you know, not a cannabis prisoner. He was a violent guy, you know.
Yeah,
but they're very reluctant to do it, and that's the issue. That's the problem. And so you have to put a lot of pressure on, a public pressure on, like we're doing Michael Thompson's. And like we do Craig to a certain extent, to try to, you know, use and let the governor know that, hey, there's a lot of people in the public that want to see this happen. You've got support. You've got cover.
Yeah.
So you can sign this petition, because then, you know, if the worst thing should happen, you can always say, well, look, you know, a whole bunch of people wanted him freed and there's this big campaign and I was listening to my constituents, and, you know, you can give people cover.
Right.
And so that's what we try to do. We try to make it a little easier for the politicians to sign the petition. In the case of federal, if you're doing federal time, the same process, except the president of the United States has to sign the thing, not the governor. And the thing with Fed is you usually have more opportunities to appeal in the federal court system than you do in the state court system. So it takes a little bit longer to exhaust all your appeals. A lot of our constituents in the federal system, we're working with them to try to get this done on appeal.
Right.
And make arguments to juries that, hey, look, you know, this isn't a crime anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's already done a lot of time. So maybe we can just let him out with time served.
Yeah.
And call it a day. Say this guy, because none of these people should have been locked up in the first place. This is the thing. There's no debt to society that they owe. Society owes them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, society should be lucky that all these people don't sue them, and all their families don't sue them. Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't. It's not legally possible to do that. But you know, that's the thing, right? It should have never been illegal in the first place. This is a moral imperative to correct this wrong. And I just hope we keep building momentum, because, you know, we're still at the very early stages of this work. And we've by no means gotten it done. We've got 40,000 people in the United States, and that's the conservative count. There might be two or three times that many people locked up for weed. Once you start, you know, looking at some of the other cases that involve multiple charges, because it's just the way criminal justice works in the United States is crazy, and obviously needs not just reform, complete and total transformation.
I was curious, in these days of COVID-19, how the Last Prisoner Project may be affected by that, and also the dispensary business.
Well, COVID, the biggest cases the largest outbreaks of COVID-19 in the world, I think, are in the prisons of the United States and other countries.
Yeah.
So if we just talk about our prisoners first, you know, when COVID-19 hit, Last Prisoner Project went into high gear, getting our constituents hand sanitizer, masks, as much money in their commissary accounts as we could so that they could get those things. Because when you're in prison, they don't give you a mask. You got to buy one. And it's insane, right? That I think some of the prisons now are giving the inmates masks and sanitizers. But it's terrible, the word.
That's
our first priority, right? Just take care of the prisoners themselves. Get as many out as we can. The Craig Casal, the person I was telling you about, that was a compassionate release due to COVID. We got him out because he's not a kid anymore, so he's vulnerable. So it's, in some ways, COVID has helped us get some people out, but in some ways, it's also threatened our constituents. We've had some die in prison because we couldn't get them out. So it's a really tough situation in prison, not just for prisoners, for guards, for everybody. It's a really bad situation, and the chickens are coming home to roost. We've locked up so many people in this country that, you know, it's very hard to contain a pandemic in that situation. So that's number one. Number two, luckily, Last Prisoner Project is actually, because of the George Floyd murder and the activism around that, the COVID-19 problem has not affected our donations that much and our fundraising. So actually, George Floyd and the activism around his murder, not just his murder, many, many people's murders, Breonna, many others, has energized a lot of cannabis companies. They've reached out to LPP. They made donations. They signed up for our Partnership for Freedom program. And we're actually building more momentum than we were before COVID-19. So I'm happy to report that. On the dispensary side, wow, it's a totally different experience going to a dispensary now. And I feel bad for our customers because we've had to take a lot of measures that just make the experience not so good.
Yeah.
But the weed is still there and the products are still wonderful. My team and staff are still as friendly as ever. They can't smile at you because they're wearing a mask.
Right.
but they're behind a plastic shield.
Yeah.
You'll hear a loving tone in their voice as they try to get us all through a very hard time. So,
because it was deemed essential, you know, right? It was deemed essential.
Yes, we've been deemed essential by the governor of California. Most states, other than this fool in Massachusetts who didn't, but I think Governor Baker of Massachusetts, I shouldn't call him a fool, but he made a mistake there. Yeah. And I think he's going to correct it. I think they're, or maybe he already did correct it. Yeah, you know, we were deemed essential, and that was a very smart decision. Gavin Newsom made that decision before anybody else, and he was right. If you don't have the legal market essential, then everybody's going to have to go to the legacy market, and the legacy market cannot distribute as safely as Harborside can. So, so we're following all the guidelines. You have to wear a mask when you come into our shop. You have to stand 6 feet apart. You have to stand on a special spot that we had to put on the floor.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we may have to start taking people's temperatures if, you know, it depends on the ebb and flow of the outbreaks, right? And the cases. Yeah. If we're still in the first wave here, and if things keep getting worse as we relax, as they have been, I could imagine temperature checks being a part of the experience too. So we do curbside pickup. So there's curbside pickup. When there was, you know, protests and unrest, we had to stop delivery for a second, but that's back up and running again. And the products are all there.
Yeah.
And they have not gone up in prices. despite, you know, it's costing us a little bit more to deliver the products now. So customers should feel good about that. And, you know, our main job right now is to get cannabis to the people. Whenever there's a crisis like this, people need cannabis. And our job is to get it safely to the people and make sure the access is there for folks. And we're doing a good job. Harborside is doing an excellent job of that right now. And I think everybody in the industry is doing a pretty good job of that right now. Those of us that actually have licenses and in communities that allow it.
Andrew is very passionate about the cannabis business and the social activism that goes along with it. When did he know that this was going to be his life's work?
My journey, like I shared with you, started very young. So when I first encountered cannabis as a teenager, I was in a particular situation. My first dream was to be a professional athlete, and I got hurt in high school and my career was over as an athlete. And that made me really sad and depressed because I'd had a difficult childhood and sports was a way for me to cope and find my place in the world. And that was gone.
Yeah.
And that's when my brother handed me a joint and said, look, it's time for you to open up yourself to new and different experiences. And I think he just saw I was in physical pain and wanted to help me. But I think that there was also a part of him that understood that I was 15 years old and I was at that time in my life where you have to start thinking about your future. So then the plant itself did something to me, you know, that it does to a lot of people. And my first encounter with cannabis, that first joint with my brother, you know, I was at my mom's house, we had dinner and we went upstairs and we smoked joints all night long and talked all night long that night, all about life and the future. And pretty much that night I knew cannabis was going to be part of my life. I knew I was going to trade cannabis. I did have other, you know, things I was interested in as a young man. I wanted to be a professional actor. I wanted to be on stage. I wanted to make movies. You know, this was the 1980s. There was no legal industry. I couldn't go open a shop.
Nope,
and you know, I was passionate to help change the laws, which my brother was already working on. So I was able to kind of step into something he had already been working on and help him. And so I was very lucky in the sense that I had probably the best guide you could possibly have, not just to cannabis, but other visionary plants. So I knew very early on that I was going to trade cannabis. I was hoping I would be able to have a very robust creative career and I'd be a creative person and I'd make my living that way. But, you know, I ended up making my living in the cannabis trade. And I've done plenty of creative work and made a little bit of a living doing creative work. And I hope to sort of pivot to more creative work now. But I always knew from that first joint that cannabis is going to be in my life forever. And I was going to trade in cannabis and I was going to advocate for cannabis and be a champion for cannabis because it was healing me. It opened me up to there was more things to life than just playing sports, you know, and I remember feeling a little bit bad about myself that I had focused so much on sports. I didn't know anything about music. I didn't know anything about sex. Right. I didn't know anything about, you know, art. I didn't know anything about nature. I'd never gone camping. I'd never gone hiking out in the woods all that much. You know, I had been in gyms and tennis courts and tournaments my whole life up to that point. And so it was like, whoa, man, hold on. I'm going to show you a whole nother thing. This plant is just going to open. The doors of perception just busted open. They were just knocked down and it was almost overwhelming. And it did, you know, it took me my teenage years and my college years to, you know, on a daily basis, get closer and closer to cannabis and closer to manifesting how this is all going to work in my life. And frankly, you know, these are things that we constantly have to be discovering and pivoting new ways of doing this work, because things change and get disrupted all the time. And so, you know, being nimble and knowing how to pivot is part of the journey.
Given the years of experience that Andrew has in the cannabis industry, where does he picture psychedelics going, say, in the next 10 years?
Well, I think in 10 years, we may start to see the proliferation of Rick Doblin's clinics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well within 10 years in his plan. When I talk about architecture and blueprints for psychedelic legalization and industry, I just go to maps. I just point everybody to maps, because we don't need to invent the wheel. Maps has already done it.
Yeah.
And we should just do whatever they say. it's just because one of the things I learned in cannabis is we had too many organizations. We had too many activist organizations. Right now we have too many trade associations, and that fragmentation is not helpful.
Yeah.
It's been a real problem for us. And I don't want to see that happen with psychedelics. We've got MAPS. MAPS is beautiful. MAPS is wonderful. MAPS is an incredible organization. Let's lean into MAPS. And so anybody listening, don't start your own organization, please, before you check out MAPS. Yeah. Go work for them. If you go to the MAPS website, they have some great jobs listed right now. And what happens is people get frustrated, or they don't know their space, or they don't know their spot. So they just willy nilly start an organization, and then they build it. And then all of a sudden they're competing with MAPS. Right. And it's not helpful. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to come on your show. And one of the reasons I'm going to try to be involved in the psychedelic conversation more, because we really screwed up with cannabis. Okay. With this fragmentation, not just with trade associations, but activist organizations. It's just, and the problem is we're all competing for the same funding, and then nobody has enough funding, and then nobody can do anything.
Right.
You know, and we're having this terrible problem fixing these frameworks that we got wrong the first time in California and Canada, and we can't fix them because we're too fragmented. And it's a real problem. So what do I want in 10 years? Whatever Matt says, because they've done the work, man. And I'm not smarter than they are. They are really smart people, and we should lean into them. And I think, you know, the clinics and the permits, the user permits, I guess you'd call them, those two things should be able to be in place in 10 years time. I'm not sure we're going to have I'm not sure society is going to be well trained enough in the use of these compounds to be able to trade them openly the way we do in dispensaries with cannabis.
Right.
I'm just not sure that 10 years is enough time. One thing, you know, I remember, this activity is already happening in a fairly non-harmful way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have to just be mindful, right? Because as more people become curious about cannabis, you may have millions and millions of people that want to try these compounds all around the same time. Okay. And that's where I worry, right? Because set and setting and intention are extremely important things. And until people learn those three basic pillars of responsible psychedelic use, and that, you know, 350 million people in the United States, another 30 million in Canada, have to learn those three basic things.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not sure 10 years is enough time to teach them that with all the mud in the water. Right. Because there's a lot of misinformation about psychedelics and cannabis and so forth out there in the world. As the exuberance has taken hold, particularly with cannabis. And, you know, I'd hate to see the same thing happen to psilocybin that's happened with CBD. So, but I do think it's reasonable in 10 years that we'll see the clinics and the user permits and maybe, you know, some at home usage with people who have permits.
Right. Yeah, I think, like you're saying, 10 years may not be enough just to, well, education seems to be the key. And
we're not good at it. If education is the key and we're not good at it, then that means plus time. Mm-hmm. You know, education minus competence plus time equals the right way.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're just not good at it, despite all the tools available to us. Maybe this virtual pandemic experience will get us a lot better at it.
It could be, maybe.
But gosh, we talk about education, not just with respect to cannabis and psychedelics, but with respect to kids and children and society and math and science. And gosh, my whole life, ever since I was a kid in school, they've been talking about education.
Yeah.
And we haven't been good at it.
I know.
For all that time, we haven't been good at it. I agree with you. It's absolutely the key. And that's why I want people like MAPS in the driver's seat, because they know how to do the education in a responsible and good way. They've made the mistakes. They've iterated this. So anyway.
So before we go, other than everybody should join MAPS, because for sure. Obviously, I want people to know about where they can help with the Last Prisoner Project. It's lastprisonerproject.org is the website.
Yes.
Where they can find out more.
Lastprisonerproject.org. Take a deep dive into lastprisonerproject.org. It's there's a lot to learn and experience there. And
hopefully,
spend some time.
Yeah.
There'll be a link in the show notes to the Last Prisoner Project if you want to take a look and see maybe how you can help. I finally asked Andrew if there are any other resources that he would point people to if they're interested in psychedelics.
There is a publication called Double Blind that I like a lot.
Yes, we just had them. We had them on a few weeks ago, actually, a few months ago now, I guess.
Double Blind's great. That's another group. They're doing some of that education you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they're also, they're not formally connected to MAPS, but they've been heavily influenced by the work of MAPS and they are aligned with the mission of MAPS. So I like Double Blind a lot.
Yeah, same here.
And Michael Pollan's book, everybody should read that book. It is a very, very important book. I hope he will continue to write and think and talk about psychedelics, because to have Michael Pollan as one of the thought leaders in psychedelics is a real gift that we should use and not take for granted. So those three groups are incredible starting points and great resources for your audience.
You can find links to Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, and Double Blind Magazine in the show notes. And with that, we said our goodbyes.
Thank you very much for spending some time with us here.
Well, thank you, David, for carrying this message out into the world. And I hope all your listeners will continue to move the psychedelic conversation forward and do everything in a good, safe, and responsible way.
Yeah, well, thank you for all your work. It's quite something what you've accomplished so far. It's quite amazing. Hopefully we'll get to chat again soon sometime.
Anytime, David. Thank you.
I really enjoyed my chat with Andrew. He's lived an unconventional life, and he's still fighting to change laws, get people out of jail, and provide medicine for those who need it. Before I sign off, I just wanted to mention the next episode, which will be out in a few weeks. It's regarding Alma Rumball, an artist from Ontario, Canada. We'll be talking with her niece, Wendy Oki. If you don't know Alma's work, I suggest that you take a look. We have a fascinating talk, and I think you'll really like it. One more thing. Our travels have been put on hold a little bit because of COVID-19. We made a video about our 37-hour travel back from Portugal to Canada. If you want to check that out, it's on YouTube, and there's a shorter version that'll be on Instagram as well. The Psychedelic Suitcase is produced by Carolyn Myers and myself, your host, Dave McNee. So join us next time when we unpack more of the Psychedelic Suitcase.